So the subject which Bradley chose is Hebrew DNA. I'll explain soon why Hebrew DNA, I call it DNA of creation, because DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid, has got all the plans for the human body compacted into, or for any living creature for that matter. Edmund Wilson makes a calculation that of the 1,000 million species that have lived in this planet in total, 1,000 million species, the amount of DNA you'd need, the volume of DNA you'd need to contain all the information necessary to produce 1,000 million species is a teaspoonful of DNA. They have all the information necessary for 1,000 million species. Granted, a lot of it we have in common. We share something like 98% with the great apes. We share something like 70% with rattlesnakes, if you're a politician, perhaps a little more than that. But in any case, we share a fair amount with other creatures. So I call Hebrew the DNA of creation because Hebrew contains within it, if you really understood, the Gaon of Vilna says, if you really understood the Hebrew language, Lashon HaKodesh, the holy tongue, the Hebrew language, you would understand all the depths of creation. God created the world. We just read this Shabbat, Shabbat Bereshit, Genesis. God said, let there be light, and there was light. And the way the King David puts it, he says, Bidvar Hashem Shamayim Na'asu, by the word of God, the heavens were made. Uberuach Piv, and the breath of his mouth, Kol Tzva'am, all their host. Meaning, God's word, so to speak, coalesced and manifested itself in creation. Anything in creation is a word of God. Interestingly enough, in the Hebrew language, we say, La'olam Hashem, Dvarcha, Nitzav B'Shamayim. God, your word stands in the heaven. What stands in the heaven? What stands here? Your word. Meaning, in Hebrew, it's very interesting. The word for word in Hebrew is davar. There's a word in Hebrew for thing is also davar. It's very interesting. But every davar, every thing, is also a
word.
Davar. It's a word. It's a word of God. Which means the word of God expressed in Hebrew language contains within it the code for all of creation. We will see that to a certain degree. We'll see some of that soon. So that's the basic idea here. There's a few other unique aspects to the Hebrew language. First and foremost, the code of Jewish law tells us that the Shema, which is our declaration of faith, which we say every day, twice a day, three times a day, we say it every day. There's a rule that you're allowed to say it in any language. You can say it in any language. Okay? Which means, if you don't understand Hebrew, if you cannot read Hebrew, you can say it in another language. However, there's a very interesting stipulation. Stipulation is the following. If you recite it in Hebrew, even if you don't understand Hebrew, you have fulfilled the commandment of reciting the Shema. Even if you don't understand Hebrew, right? It's Greek to you, right? But you nevertheless recite it in Hebrew. You don't understand it. You've fulfilled the commandment, the mitzvah. However, if you, let's say, the only siddur or prayer book available to you has got a French translation, and you read it in French, but you don't understand French, then according to Jewish law, you have not fulfilled the commandment. Not fulfilled the commandment if you don't understand French, if you don't understand English, if it has to be recited in the language you understand. The exception is Hebrew. Am I making myself clear? In other words, you recite it in any language you want, as long as you understand that language, and as long as that language is a spoken language. If you recite it, for example, there's a translation of the Torah into Klingon. Klingon is the language of the Klingons from Star Trek. Okay, the Klingons, which is problematic because the Klingons are atheists. So they had to cut. The word for God in Klingon is Jopha, which means the Great Lord. But either way, I know a little Klingon. But if you recite it in Klingon, which is not a spoken language, and you don't understand, you have not fulfilled the mitzvah. Why is that? So if you have a look, at the Chafetz Chaim, great sage, in his commentary on Jewish law, says the following. All languages are only languages due to their common usage. They have meaning only due to the consensus. However, when there's no usage or consensus, the language has no status as a language. It has no intrinsic meaning. If in English, this is a table. There's no intrinsic meaning to the word table that describes anything essential about this object here. This is, in other words, it's a consensus. Somehow it developed, right, that people decide to call something something. You know, whatever it was, that day and night, caveman fag walked out of his cave and stubbed his foot on a table. And he said, oh, darn table. So the word table became the way in which it's expressed. But there's nothing intrinsic about it. In Hebrew, as the Bishop Baruch says, Hebrew is, however, an intrinsic language. It has intrinsic meaning even if I don't understand it. very, very interesting point. What that's saying is that Hebrew describes things in their essence. The language that comes... anyone know what language comes closest to Hebrew in that sense? Aramaic is really a form of Hebrew, yes. But Greek says one of the few languages that it's appropriate to translate is in fact Greek, because Greek also in a sense describes what's going on, although in a very different way, but it does describe things more in an essential manner rather than English or most other languages. It's interesting, the first translation of the Bible was into Greek. So that when Ptolemy, the Greek ruler of Egypt, he asked 70 rabbis to gather together, and he put them in separate cubicles, and he said, translate the 5 books of Moses into Greek. And they did so. Miraculously, the Talmud says, they all came out with exactly the same translation. And of course, there's a contemporary rabbi, Rabbi Huttner, who always asks, he says, I don't understand why that was miraculous. What's so miraculous? He said, they were in separate rooms. Of course they agreed. If they'd be in the same room and agreed, that would be miraculous. Like, exactly. But in any case, so the Hebrew language has 2 features so far. Feature number 1 of the Hebrew language is that it is the language with which God created the world, which means it is the language that is the essence of creation itself. Number 2, it is a language, the etzem, which means in essence a language. By the way, I here am referring to biblical Hebrew. Modern Hebrew has many features which are not essential. In other words, just for example, I had an officer in the army who said to me the following sentence. See if you're Hebrew. That's my name. He said, "Nitzarech ledaskes et hasituatzia bebasis." We will have to ledaskes to discuss. Excellent, your Hebrew is very good. Et hasituatzia, very good. Well, we've got a lot of Hebrew speakers here. Et hasituatzia, the situation bebasis, in the base. We have to discuss situation in the base. Very good. And then he once asked me, "Becher atama duplam, me duplam? Are you me duplam? What's me duplam?"
You have a diploma.
Excellent, you have a diploma. Right. So now while a person who speaks modern Hebrew certainly could communicate with someone who speaks ancient biblical Hebrew, no question about it, right? But there are some differences. Okay. But in any case, biblical Hebrew describes things as they are in their essence. I remember we had my father knows Hebrew. My father can speak Hebrew, but his Hebrew he learnt totally from the 5 books from the Torah. From the 5 books of Moses, the prophets, and the writings. I remember when I was a little kid, we had a captain from a Zim ship, one of the first earlier. So I don't know how it worked out, but my father managed to invite the captain and his son for Shabbat lunch. So the captain comes and his son, secular Jews from Israel, and my father is speaking to them in Hebrew. And it's interesting, I also spoke Hebrew because I went to a Hebrew speaking school from the time I was in kindergarten. So in Australia, called Bialik College, named after a great Hebrew poet. In any case, I could understand this, but my father gets up and leaves the room, and the little Israeli kid says to his father, he says, Abba, pointing out Vi, is he a prophet? Because it sounded as though the prophet Jeremiah had sat down at the table and was speaking, you know what I mean? But so we can communicate. A modern Israeli and a prophet Jeremiah could communicate. Right, but here I'm referring to the essence, which is the Hebrew language. So that's the second point. Point number 3, and this is a point made beautifully by David Ben-Gurion. By the way, for those who think they'll forget all this, I have an outline with all these quotes on it, which I'll give out to you after. So in any case, but David Ben-Gurion points out a very beautiful idea. He says, I appreciate practical value of being able to name all the parts of a tractor is very important. Being a, by the way, what is a rear axle in Hebrew? Axle. Rear axle. What is a front axle in Hebrew? Rear axle kidney. That means a front rear axle. But in any case, he says, I appreciate the being able to name all the parts of the tractor. That's very important. But he says, and this is an amazing thing, he says, a Jew who can name all the plants of Israel in Hebrew, or call all the parts of a tractor or a complicated machine by correct designations in New Hebrew, is certainly, no one could fail to see in this something of great value. However, he says, if he does not know in their deepest sounding and in their context of spiritual tensions, Hebrew expressions such as mitzvah, aveira, ge'ulah, redemption, tikkun, correction of the world, tum'ah, impurity, tahara, purity, yir'ah, fear, ahava, love, tzedakah, charity, right? Chesed, kindness, mesirut nefesh, self-sacrifice, kiddush Hashem, devekut, teshuvah. If he doesn't understand those words, then he cannot carry part in the choir that gives voice, consciously or not, to what he calls the Jewish melody. He says, even so-called secular Jewish education, Drail and the Galut, if it is not to be drained of the powers that build the Jewish personality, must be nourished from sources which are identified, regarded at least formally, as religious. David Ben-Gurion was certainly not a religious Jew, but he had an understanding of the power of our connection, of our tradition and of our language and our heritage. And he understood that if a Jew doesn't understand these terms, if he can name the parts of a tract, he can say Ru Axel Kidni, and he knows what an Mshesheser is, etc., etc., but he doesn't, not familiar with the term Chesed, Tikkun, Tum'ah, Tahara, Mitzvah, Avera, he says, then he's not familiar with the choir of Judaism, which has been part of our family, our people throughout the years. And he's pointing out a very important point. There's a third component to the importance of the Hebrew language. It is the unifying factor of the Jewish people. It is all over the world. The language of our prayers are Hebrew. It's very interesting. I spoke in Los Angeles. And I was staying at the home of a guy who was formerly a principal at the community day school in Cincinnati. And in Cincinnati, the community day school had children from who were Orthodox and who were conservative and Reform and Reconstructionist and Reconstructure Orthodox, whatever, everything, right? So it was a community day school. So he took them on a trip to Israel. On the trip to Israel, it was very interesting. They were staying at a hotel which was not far. Well, it's in Jerusalem, so there is no such thing as a hotel which is far from a synagogue, right? I mean, it's like, so they were staying at, and the synagogue was an Orthodox synagogue. So he took them to this Orthodox shul on Friday night. The children, who were familiar in Cincinnati with the Reform service, complained. They said, everything's in Hebrew. They said, we don't understand anything. We're not used to this, right? Isn't there a Reform temple somewhere in Jerusalem? And the principal said, yes, there is. I will assign one of the madrichim, one of the counselors, to walk with you there. It's on King David Street, right near the King David Hotel. You're welcome. We'll go there. You can go there tomorrow morning. They went there the next morning. They come back. They're upset. He said, why are you upset? He says, that was also in Hebrew. He said, what do you expect? It's Israel. They thought, since the Reform Temple in America, the service was in English in Cincinnati, they'd come to Israel, get an English service, said, hello, it's Israel. So it's interesting. So, you know, on the one hand, he said that was pretty amusing, but on the other hand, one of the kids came over to him and said, you know what, we've been robbed. We've been who we are, right? We should be able to come to Israel. We can't come to Israel and feel comfortable in a service because it's in a foreign language. That's our language. Why was it taken away from us? It's a very our language. It's a very beautiful, unifying idea. People from different countries. I've been to shuls in Hong Kong, in Singapore, in England, right, in Moscow, all over Israel, in South Africa, in Australia, all over the United States. Right, I've never had a problem. Because Hebrew is right. Even places divided by language, Brooklyn and London, for example, right? They're radically different languages, but nevertheless, the prayers are in the same language. It's a very beautiful thing. And I think that might be what David Ben-Gurion is referring to here. Now, the sources I'm going to be using, I divide into two categories. Primary, for those who cannot see. But the first of all, the Babylonian Talmud, specifically in Tractate Shabbat, which in chapter 17. Chapter 17 of the Talmud in Shabbat talks about the prohibition of building Sabbath. What a build, right? So you cannot build on Sabbath. So it's interesting, there in that chapter it talks all about the alphabet, the Hebrew alphabet. Why do you think it does that? What's the connection? Book, in the chapter that talks about the prohibition against building on the Sabbath, it talks about the Hebrew alphabet. What's the connection? Mm-hmm. Build, words. What are the building blocks of words? Letters. The stones of words are the letters, right? And not only that, but on a deeper level, what were the building blocks of the world? The Hebrew alphabet, which God used to create the world. Therefore, in chapter Haboneh, the builder, that is where the Hebrew alphabet is. Otziot de Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva, very great Talmudic sage, has a book in which he goes through the essence and the meaning of each letter of the Hebrew alphabet. Sefer Yetzirah, which means the book of creation, this is attributed to Abraham Avinu, involves the idea of creation. It talks about how God used language to create the world. Zohar, which is the Jewish mystical tradition, written in the form of a commentary on the five books of Moses by the students of Rav Shimon bar Yochai in about 200 CE, first published by Rav Moshe de Leon in Spain in about 13th century. secondary sources, the Gaon of Vilna, he has a very interesting, he has certain rules. That one of the rules is the first appearance rule, which means he says the first time a word appears in the Torah or a letter appears in the Torah, that is defining, that defines it for the rest of time, which is very, I think, here. But let's say the first time the Torah uses the word good. You want to know what the word good means in Hebrew? Tov? Have a look in the Torah, first time it uses it. We just read it yesterday. Very interesting. I spoke about this with my kids at lunchtime. What day of creation does it not say, and God saw that it was good? Vayar Elokim Kitov, God saw that it was good. What day of creation does it not say that? Oh, it's interesting. Yeah, my Rafi, my four-year-old, said Shabbos doesn't say that, and he's right. So, but I said, but that's actually not what I'm looking for, because on Shabbos God didn't create anything. Right, so which of the days of creation does it not say, and it was good? Yes, second day of creation. The second day of creation doesn't say it. On the third day of creation, it says it twice. Now, the reason here is, and this will give us a definition of the word tov in Hebrew. You see, on the second day of creation, God separated the waters above and the waters below. So the Talmud says, why? Lama lo ne'emar ki tov b'yom sheni? Why does it not say it was good on the second day? Shebo nivra hamachloket. Division was created on the second day. Two, by the way, is the number of division. It's the number, the first number where there's a split. There's one is unity. Two is splitting apart, separate. So on the third day of creation, it says ki tov twice. It was good twice. Why? Because that was the day where, first of all, the rain cycle and the agricultural cycle joined together the heaven and earth in that sense. There was a chibur, a joining together. And hence, numerically, when you think about it, that's what three does. One is unity. Two means separation, because there's now two. Three already means that those three objects, which apparently are separate, there's enough in common to count them as three. Interestingly enough, the word shalosh is also the root of another word, shalshelet. What's a shalshelet? Chain. A chain. Or a dynasty is also, that's a metaphorical use of it. But yes, a chain is a shalshelet. Because what does it do? That is the first appearance rule. That's one example of the first appearance rule. Second secondary source is Rabbi David Kimchi. Rabbi David Kimchi, great grammarian, wrote what's called the Book of Roots, in which this is the defining book. In Hebrew, very interesting, almost all words in the Hebrew language are connected by two letter roots called shoroshim. In other words, you can very often, if you teach kids correctly, you can teach them to look for the three letter shoresh, and then you stick a prefix on a suffix and you can create words and sentences out of the roots. So the words in Hebrew are connected by these roots. We'll look at them later. Rabbi David Kimchi of the 13th century wrote an entire book of this. One of the reasons he was arrested in this was he possessed a seditious book, a dangerous book. The book was 1,000 Hebrew words. Book that was a danger to the Soviet Union, and the Bible, it was a danger because Jews stopped learning Hebrew and identifying with other Jews and with Israel. That was the first crack, Iron Curtain, wasn't it? Right, the whole thing was a result of that. Okay, the Maharal of Prague. Rabbi Yehuda Lerva of Prague, 17th century, one of the very, very greatest of our mystics and philosophers, also a lot of discussion about the Hebrew language. And Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch, 19th century German rabbi, brilliant in his knowledge of grammar, wrote a lot of commentaries about that. Okay, now Hebrew has evolved. There are different scripts of Hebrew. What I have here is this is the ancient Hebrew script, or Ktav Ivri, ancient Hebrew script. I actually have some things here you can pass around if you'd like. Pass it around. That is written in ancient Hebrew script. That's called the Tel Dan Stele. And these are some seal impressions from various kings of Judah. This is written in ancient Hebrew script. So the script has changed. But like, for instance, this letter here. Hold on. Let me see. Yeah, see that letter? What does that look like to you folks?
Number four.
Third is standing up. It's a. Lying on its side. What does it look like?
Like an A.
Like an A, right? That one there. You see? Triangle bisected by a line? It's an A. Right? Actually, that's the ancient Hebrew script for Aleph.
Oh, really?
Yes. The ancient Hebrew letter for Aleph is actually that.
Can we go back to that? Maybe we'll be
Well, we'll see. For instance, that. No, but actually turn it upside down mem. Is the ancient Hebrew letter mem. What does that look like to you? Does it look like an M?
Yeah.
Very often Jews have been written out of history. In archaeology and in many places, if you read books on archaeology, you'll find it's almost as if the Israelites, the Jews in Israel, never ever produced any pottery. We were there for over 2,000 years, never produced it. Why? Pottery is always described as proto-Canaanite, Phoenician, right, Cypriot style, Canaanite, right, Iron Age. Never do you have Jewish pottery. Why not? What, the Jews didn't produce any pottery? What, we didn't have cooking pots? For 2,500 years we were in Israel, nothing? We've been written out of history. And here's one of the areas. You look at the Hebrew alphabet and the ancient, the English alphabet, the Greek alphabet. What is the word alphabet? Is a Greek word. Alphabet comes from the Hebrew aleph, bet. Alpha, beta, gamma, delta, aleph, bet, gimel, dalet. It's a transliteration of our alphabet. So this is ancient Hebrew script. Here is just an example. This is the ancient Hebrew script here, aligned with the actual regular aleph bet that we use today. So there's an aleph, right? That's a bet. See the bet? Mm-hmm. Oh, okay, dalet. Like, yes, exactly, the Greek delta, right? Hey, vav, right? Zion, look at the Zion. Z letter, is it, what letter is it?
Z.
It's a Z. Actually, it's a Z, but we'll accept your American. Right, look at the lamed. Look at the lamed.
Oh.
Okay, mem, that's a mem. Turn it upside down, it's a? M. What about that? Nun, N. Yeah. Turn it upside, it's an N. Right, S, samach, S. Okay, ayin. Ayin is like an up. Oh, right, an O, right? Pei, sort of like a P, almost. Right, shin. It's actually a W and a tough an X. But very interesting. The ancient Hebrew script, I believe, and if you, I don't know if you can see it, then you can see it. But that's the Ketuv Ivri Yashan. The Hebrew alphabet. Of course, there are different ways of writing it. Traditionally, we talk about 22 letters, but the truth is, there are certain letters which are written in different ways when at the end of a word. You ever heard of that? It's called the sofit, the end letters. In Yiddish, they call it the ender letters, or the sofit in Hebrew. Right? And those are the different ways of writing the alphabet. What's interesting is, also in Hebrew, there's no numbers. Hebrew has no numbers. Right? Numbers are written by letters. If you wanted to write the Hebrew year, is this year, Tafshin, it's 5-7,
Six.
So you'd actually write it in Hebrew, ancient Hebrew. You'd write Taf, Shin, Samach, Vav. You'd write it as letters. Every letter of the Hebrew alphabet has a numerical value. So Aleph obviously is 1. It goes from 1 to 10, right? Then it goes 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, to 100. Then it goes 200, 300, 400. And therefore, every word in Hebrew is also going to have a numerical value, what we call a gematria, which is actually a Greek word. Greeks also had a form of gematria, by the way. We'll talk a little bit about that later. But it's numerical value. In Israel today, if I were to write the date on a check, in Israel, if I were writing a check, I could write, for instance, today, Kaf Chet Tishrei. Kaf Chet Tishrei would mean the 28th of Tishrei, the month of Tishrei. Kaf Chet, 20 and 8.
Why did it change from
that? Question, exactly how that evolved in that way. Some say that it was actually a deliberate act of Ezra, the scribe, who decided to incorporate many of the lessons of the Hebrew language into the shape of the letters. In other words, he wanted to incorporate lessons of Hebrew into the shape of the letters, some say, and therefore he used this script. Others say that this script was always used for the Torah. This was the script which the Torah was given. However, for daily speech, since this script is very holy, it was only used for three things. What are the three things it was used for? A scroll. Anything else? Tefillah. And? Mezuzah. Right? That's the only three things it was used for. Right? In fact, even today, it is common custom not to use this script for anything else but Torah, Tefillah, Mezuzah. Therefore, another script was used, the ancient Hebrew script. Today, in Israel, we don't use the ancient Hebrew script, and we don't use this either. In Israel, we just write in what's called cursive script, which is actually very different from the others. And again, it's part of this idea to have a different script than the Torah scroll. Now, if you look at this script, it's actually a little different from the regular script. This is actually how the Torah scroll, and it's called Ketav Ashurit. Ashurit means, it actually has three meanings. Ashurit means either happy, Osher, Right? Osher with an ayin means wealth. Osher with an aleph. By the way, Ashkenazim, European Jews, don't distinguish between aleph, and that's incorrect. Right? There should actually be the aleph is aleph. Ayin is ayin. So if I would be speaking Hebrew correctly, I would say osher, which means wealth, and you could hear that was an ayin. For instance, the word Shema Yisrael, everyone knows Shema Yisrael, right? So Shema Yisrael is not precise. Is not a precise pronunciation. Really, the precise pronunciation should be Shema. Drink, you know, have some alcohol, whatever that you can do. Right, Shema, right, is the actual correct pronunciation to guttural. So, okay, so this is the writing, and we'll talk about, so Tavashur means the happy script. Sometimes it also means, Ishur means a certification. If you want to get a stamp on something in Israel, it's called Ishur. So this is the certified script. Maimonides actually writes in a responsa, by the way, this script, anyone know what this script is called? That's called Rashi script. Interestingly enough, Rashi himself never wrote in that script. It's just the first book ever printed using that script was Rashi's commentary on the Torah. So hence it's called Rashi script. But it was also, it was an ancient Sephardi script used by the Jews of the North Africa and the Middle East to avoid using the script of the Torah. And Maimonides writes, there's an ancient custom not to use the script of the Torah for anything but Torah, Tefillin, and Mezuzah. That's why we don't find any of this script at all on remnants of the ancient Israelites, neither on coins or stone inscriptions. And actually, if you look through, oh, you saw the stone inscriptions here and the coins, you don't actually find the, generally, not, there's one or two exceptions, but usually you don't find any of any script of the Torah, you only find the ancient script. Now, here's an example, one example of square script. You can archaeology class, I go through this. Can anyone read that? It says, Lebet, the house of, Ha-Tekia. What's Tekia? Blowing, the blowing. Le-Hach-Liz, which means to. That was where the Kohen, the priest, would stand on the temple wall and blow a trumpet to proclaim the arrival of Shabbat. That's why in Israel, Friday afternoon, 40 minutes before sundown, a lot of cities you hear a siren going off. That sirens tell you that it's time for Shabbat. Now, here, I want to go into some of the letters. Hebrews, one of the unique factors in Hebrew is, if you really understand letters, you could actually figure out words. I'll say that again. If you understand the meaning of the letters, you could figure out words. In other words, if you wanted to know what Hebrew meant, you wouldn't need a dictionary. You know what you'd need? Understand each letter. When you understood each letter, you'd look at a word, you know what the word means. You cannot do that in any other language, to my knowledge. I don't know all languages, but as far as I know, right, you cannot do that in other languages. Let me give you some examples. The Aleph, which is the traditional Aleph, notice that the Aleph is composed of three letters. What three letters are composed of? Yud, a Yud, and a Vav. See? Yud, Vav, Yud. You've got one Yud upside down, one Yud the right way, and the Vav there. Does everyone see that? Yud is the first letter of God's name. First letter of God's name is Yud. Yud is also the first letter of Yisrael, which means Israel, the Jewish people. What is Vav? If you put Vav in front of a word, what does that mean?
And.
So Vav is a connector. So Aleph is, it connects the connected. That's the Aleph. In other words, the very first thing, the one. Oneness, unity of God and the Jewish people. We say this in our Shabbos afternoon, in the afternoon service, say, Ata Echad, V'Shimcha Echad, U'mika Amcha Yisrael Goy Echad Ba'aretz. You are one, your name is one, who is like your people Israel, one nation in the land. So that's what Aleph means. Aleph, interestingly enough, has other meanings as well. The very letter, the word Aleph, means what? If I say the word Aleph, there's a word in Hebrew, Ulpan. What's an Ulpan? Language, it's a place where you go in Israel to learn Hebrew. Ulpan actually is from the word to learn or to study. And Ulpan is a studio. Study, studio. Ulpan studio from the word Aleph, which means to learn or to teach. That, in the word Aleph, there are two words there. El, peh, which means what? Towards. So I'm teaching. Right? It's towards, right? It's the intellect, mouth, and extending outwards. Right, in action of two people, the Yud, and the Vav. Beit is, notice this is how the Beit is written. Beit, the word Beit means what?
No.
About a house. In fact, if you put the Beit right, you put on, it would look like a little house. Right, but the idea of Beit is that's the first letter of the Torah. When God created the world, He created the world. The first letter is Beit. He created a place of dwelling. a house. More than that, you see the bait is rigged, it's got a little thing, see that little decoration, it's got a little decoration pointing back. Right, what are those purposes of decorations? The Talmud says, if you ask bait who created you, it points up and it says God. You ask him what his name is, it points back and it says Aleph, his name is one. What does it ask the bait? Because you see, bait is the letter 2. Why does creation start with the letter 2? Or the number 2? Or the word, the letter 2? The answer is, because before creation there was only unity. There was God. Creation is the appearance of plurality. The appearance that there's more than one. The appearance that beyond God, which is not true. It's an illusion. There's an illusion in this world. The illusion in this world is that we are disconnected from God. The illusion in this world is that there's not Aleph. We're not connected. The illusion in this world is, you see, if you look at the bait, it disconnects from the Aleph, doesn't it? The Aleph is in front of the bait. The bait is opened that way, but it's closed off in that direction. Because creation and the very existence of a physical world indicates what? It's an illusion that we are disconnected. We have an independent existence, which we don't really, because we are connected to God. Whether we know it or not, we are connected to God. We just don't realize it. And so creation is the illusion of more than one. That's why it's bait. And that's why it's important that in the bait, there's indicators, there's pointers, just like there is in the world. There's pointers and indicators in the world that point up to God, point back to his unity. That's the idea of the bait. Gimel, interesting, Gimel is, if you spell out Gimel, it's Gimel. Ligmol means to give. Animal, there's an animal called a gamal, which is a
camel.
The English word camel, by gamal. That's pretty obvious, right? So, but a camel and gamal, the ancient word for camel is gamal. The English word camel is straight out of the Hebrew, Oxford etymology. So, but gimel means to give, to bestow. So, right? So Aleph is unity. It's before there was a creation. Bait is plurality, two, more than one, independent, it's disconnected from God. How do you get reconnected? You imitate God. Gimel means to give. The next letter is Dalet. Dalet actually is also the word for poor. Dal is a poor person. How do you become connected once again to God? Gomel Dalim, by giving to the poor. By becoming an imitator of God, becoming a creator, becoming a giver. And what's the letter after Gomel, Gimel, Dalet, give to the poor? What's the letter after that?
Hey.
Hey, second letter of God's name. Becoming connected again to God. So the process of creation is there, the process of creation and reconnection, disconnection and reconnection is there in the Aleph base. If you understand the meaning here, for example, so Aleph, as we said, is Aleph. It also means to teach, but also means a thousand. Aleph is the word for a thousand. Aleph is one. Right? It is, so to speak, a greater unity from very different parts. When you get to start counting, and you get to 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, you get to bigger and bigger unities. Every time you get to a new level of like a 10 or 100 or a 1,000, you get to a level of unity where you're taking disparate things and uniting them together. El Pet, right? Get from the brain to the mouth to teach. Aluf, to teach. By the way, Aluf in Hebrew also is a champion or a superior or a general. Aluf, because it's Aluf. Who's number one? The champion is number one, right? So Aluf, champion, is actually the letter Aluf as well. Beit, again, as I said, is Beit, house. It's interesting, it's the first letter of the word Bana, which means to build. It's the first letter of the word Bina, which means... So Bina, there's different words for knowledge in English and also in Hebrew. There's Chochma and Bina, right? What's in between Chochma and Bina? Chochma is knowledge. Bina is the ability to build on that knowledge, to put the facts together. So therefore the word Bina, which is understanding, building, putting facts together, is the same root as Boneh, which means to build. Because what does Bina do? It builds one fact into the other and builds it into a Bayit, a house of knowledge. Even is a stone. It's the basis of all building. Even, right? It also contains within it the building blocks of generations. Av, father, and Ben, which is
son.
Av and Ben, right? That's also a building block. Gimel, as we said, is give. Gomel, to give. Ligmol, interestingly enough, Gomel means to give. Ligmol means to wean. Mother is nursing a child. The mother stops nursing a child. That's called ligmol. To wean. So what, don't you find it strange that to give and to wean, isn't weaning the opposite of giving? What is it weaning? It means to take away, stop nursing the child. So gomel is to give and to nurture. Ligmol is to stop nurturing. So are they opposites?
No.
Why not? What's it teaching us here? It's teaching us, I think, a very important thing. Is the best giving is a giving which you can ultimately, eventually, stop the dependence. And that you are giving to the person to the point where they can become independent. Right? With all due respect to La Lecture. Right? But eventually, you've got to let go. Right? Eventually, right? You know, the child, right? The child, you know, teaching a child to ride a bike, at some point, you've got to let go of the seat. 14-year-old boy riding to school on his bike, and dad's running behind him, holding the seat. Right? That's child abuse. Okay? That's not giving. Right? You've got to be able to give. So giving involves also the ability to wean. Right? In fact, the highest level of charity, Maimonides tells us, is not giving money. Why? Because it's ligmol to give, but it's also involved in it is ligmol to wean. Gadol, by the way, the first letter of gadol is to grow. Right? How do you make someone grow? By doing both. Gomel, nurturing, and ligmol, weaning. That's how you make. In fact, the first time gimel appears in the Torah is in the sense of gadol. That's why gimel, by the way, I should point out, is the feminine letter. Gimel is the letter of the feminine. Because gimel is to nurture, to wean, and to make something grow. What a woman does. Right? She knows when to nurture, she knows when to wean, and she makes things grow and great from small to great through that. So gimel is, so to speak, the feminine letter. Dalet, as I said, is poor. Right? Dal. It also means door. Poor. Why would door and poor be the same? There are numerous explanations for this, but one of the possibilities is that, as we said before, the way to connect, the doorway to connect to God is through giving to someone, is through being a giver. Because that's our imitation of God. Our prime imitation of God is opening the door and giving. Hey, the word hey, interestingly enough, if you look in the Bible, the letter hey is also a word by itself. It means, what does the word hey mean? It's interesting. Right, Joseph, when he tells the Egyptians, he gives the Egyptians a starving, and he gives them seeds to sow, to plant. He says, hey lachem zera, I give to you seed to plant. So the letter hey means to give. Interestingly enough, the middle letter of the word ahav, ahav means?
Love.
The middle letter of the word ahav is hey, which is giving. To give. Because love means giving. We've discussed this in other classes, but a very famous idea of Dessler says, he says, most people when they say I love, does not mean I love him or her, it means they love themselves. Example, right? I love fish. What do you generally do after having declared your love for fish?
Eat it.
Kill it, skin it, gut it, fry it, and then eat it. You're a fish lover. You're a fish lover. You chuck it back in the Hudson, right? Or maybe a better body of water. But either way, right? That's not called fish. That's called self-love. What it means is I love myself, and I deserve the charred fish carcass to satiate myself, right? When we say I love him and her, we mean often the same thing. I love myself. The physical, economic, psychological, and social benefits of my relationship with him, her, are pleasing to me. Right? It's a self-love. But love, in the Torah sense, is ahev. It's aleph. Actually, it's interesting. It's aleph, one. Become one and two, right? See, it's also the Talmud says that a man and a woman, when there is love and peace between them, the divine presence is actually, and actually interesting, the numerical value of ahav is 13, which is the same numerical value of the word echad, which is echad means. So vav, if you go into the Home Depot in Israel and ask for a vav, what will they give you? A hook. In Hebrew, a vav is a hook. Now, what do we say that the letter vav does when you put it in front of a word? And. What is and? Is and a verbal hook, is it not?
Yeah.
And if you look at the letter vav, what does it look like? It's a hook. Right? So, vav is a hook. Zayin is the letter is 7. It's also the letter for a male. The first time it appears is with a male. And zachar, who's a male. See, zayin means two things. It means a weapon. And it means, we say it in our grace after meals, hazan et hakol. Hazan et hakol. What does hazan mean? Who? Satiate. What is the traditional male roles? Two things. The weapon and the plow, so to speak, right? It is the what anthropologists call that?
The hunter.
The hunter-gatherer. The hunter-gatherer. Yeah. Right? The zayin and the zan, meaning the weapon and the satiation. So the female letter is nurturing, weaning, causing to grow. The male letter is the weapon, protection, Right? Zan, sustenance, right? Food, right? And Zachar, which also doesn't only mean male, it also means to remember, right? The generally the role assigned to transmit the facts of the tradition are assigned to the male, right? So you have the female letter is Zayin, is Gimel, the nurture, the weaning, the growing. The male letter is Zayin, right? Vav means, as we said, Vav is and, which means a hook, to join together. It's kind of interesting, because if you notice something, we said Zayin is Zachar, right? Gimel is, which is male. Gimel is Nekeva, which is female. What is Vav? Connection. So put male and female and together, what word do you get?
Couple.
In Hebrew, a married couple, a man and a woman, is called a zug. Why are they called a zug? I'll tell you, this is what I said before, right? If you understand the Hebrew letters, you can make a word, and the word would be correct. If you understand that Zayin means male, and a Gimel means female, and Vav means and, to join together, then it's obvious that zug will be a couple. I can't guarantee that you'll be able to do this with every word, right? But this is how this is how it works. It's an amazing feature of the Hebrew language. We'll see this in a few dots, right? Roots, we talked about three-letter roots. The three-letter roots tell us enormous things. For instance, Adam. Yeah. Adam is human, okay? And human is from two words, from Adama, which means earth. How else can you read how else can you read those four letters? Interesting, you can read it as E-da-me. Adama means earth. E-da-me means I will become similar to God. Humans can be earth, dirt, or we can become similar to God. Within the name Adam, human, is our potential to be the highest or the lowest point of creation. We could be dirt or we could be like God. That's where the human being is. Adam. Adam. Edamet. Behema is different. Behema is composed of two letters. No offense to Prince here, but Behema is Ba-ma. What's in it is what you get. What does that mean? What you see is what you get. There is no possibility of repentance. There's no possibility. No possibility of change. You're not going to get a coyote becoming a vegetarian, right? Or a cow kicking its alfalfa habit, right? This is not going to happen, right? There is ba-ma. What you see is what you get. Human beings, the potential animal may be very nice, but what you see is what you get. Yeah.
Can we go back to Adam?
See, Adam is dam as blood, and it's the Aleph. Aleph is God, human being joined together. So if you've just got the blood, but without God, so Behema is Ba-ma, what's in it is what you see. Eretz, the earth is our very first verse of the Torah. It says, in the beginning God created Shamayim and Eretz, heaven and earth. Heaven and earth doesn't actually, most commentaries say, does not mean the sky and the land. Does not mean that. The world and the spiritual world. The physical world is called Eretz. Why is it called Eretz? Because it's related to two words in Hebrew. Eretz is related to Ratz. What does Ratz mean?
Run.
And Ratzon. What's Ratzon mean?
To want.
The physical world is the place where we run to get what we want. It's the place of the pursuit of desire. It's a place where we run, where we move. The world moves. We move. Right? Yes, right. Mobilis immobile. What was the motto from 20,000 Leagues? Whatever. Mobile, right. Moving in a movable element. Right. We move in the world which moves. The whole physical world is ruts, is running. Now, it's interesting. So that's what the physical world describes as a place of ruts, running, and rutson, desire. But every single person, I guarantee you, there's not a person in the world who doesn't run here. Everyone runs to a particular place. Where does everyone run to? The place that everyone is running towards. There.
Sham.
Right? What's there? Sham. Let me ask you something. If you'd like to, the place where every desire and every goal and every end ultimately is going to be ultimately in the spiritual world. So the plural of Sham, which means there, is?
Shamayim.
Shamayim. Heaven, right? We call heaven, I mean the sky. We mean the spiritual existence, the world of Olam HaNeshamot, the world of the souls. The world of the souls is the world of every there that exists. Every there. Everyone says, I'm going there. What do you mean you're going there? Well, I want to get to retirement. That's all. And when you retire, that's it. No! Right? I want to get there, right? Retirement's get there. What do you want to get there? There. Every there, sham. Every single sham, take all the shams, all the theirs. All the goals, the logos, the telos, whatever language you want to say it, right? Every goal that everyone has, right? The end of everything is sham, there. And the so the spiritual world is Sham, the ultimate goal. The world is Eretz, the Ruth, the place of running. Is this clear so far? Name means name because we believe that the Hebrew name indicates where I'm going. In other words, it tells me something about my essence. My essence is where I'm going. And so the Shem and Sham actually are connected in that way as well. Now, where do we run to pursue this? In the Olam, the world. Now, the world is actually connected to He'elem. The word He'elem means concealment. Because this physical world is a world of concealment. God created is what we call in Kabbalah Tzimtzum, a concealment of the divine presence in free will. If there were no concealment of the divine presence, there'd be no free will. So this is the Olam, the world, is also the same root as the word He'elem, hiddenness. Av, father. The Latin, French word, the Latin and the French ultimately for the head of some organization, monastery, etc., is called an abbey. It's from the word Abba. Right? So Av is father, Ava is desire. Aviv is springtime. Springtime is the time of sprouting of the Nishaya. It's interesting, biologically, the role of the male, of the father, is the initial desire, the initial uncontrolled, infinite potential, almost infinite potential. In the form of the seed, in the form of the desire, it's an uncontrolled potential. Okay, that's the Av. It's Aviv, it's the spring. It's avat, the desire. Interestingly enough, aim, the mother, in Hebrew, aim means mother, aim also means womb. Aim, also the letters of im, which means if. Yeah. Biologically, it's also so. She takes only one of the possible potentials and develops that and says, this will save and thrive. This will grow, and the others will not. It is, the taking of the infinite potential, of the uncontrolled desire, and controlling it, and saying, if this, then that. Like a dialogue box in a computer program. Right? If this, then okay. If not, then not. Right? It's the aim, the mother, and the womb is also the im, the conditioner. So to speak, the thing which takes that uncontrolled set, and it's interesting, emotionally, we find that Abraham's desire and love would have extended also to Ishmael, if not for the fact Sarah said, get him out of the house, and God agreed with her. Isaac's desire and love would have extended to Esau, if not for the fact that Rivka made sure that it went to Jacob, right? And indeed, Jacob did not want to leave the house of Laban until he got a command from God, whereas his wives, Rachel and Leah, already said, we have no further portion with our father. They already had, intuitively, the condition. They already knew this was not good. This will work, this will not work. But the male desire was uncontrolled, so to speak. That's Av and Ein.
It's also Av.
No, that's with an Ayin. That's because we're Ashkenazim, so we made that mistake. So you would know, is a people. Say it with me. Okay, everyone. Anyway, Shabbat. Shabbat is the Sabbath. Related to a few words. It's related to Shav, which means to sit, which means best, but also it's related to Tashuv, which means to return. On Shabbat, what are we returning to? We're returning to the Garden of Eden. We're returning to the pre-sin state. So it's not only rest, it's also return. Teshuvah is return. Right? If I never was there, I was never good. Right? Now I'm doing teshuvah. What do you mean I'm returning? The answer is I'm returning to the essential state of the soul, which is pure. The essential state of my soul is pure. And I'm returning to that.
Question.
Yes?
Shabbat, does that have anything to do with the word
Well, yes, in modern Hebrew, shvitah is a strike because no one's working.
Is that
with the tip? Right? No, it's with a tough. Shvitah is a strike. For the obvious connection is they're sitting there and they're not doing a darn thing. They're striking, right?
You don't worry about you.
That indeed is the natural state of the workers in Israel. Is very often like that, right? It's a shvita, right? So they're returning to the natural state, right? The histadrut will, I'm not going to get into a political thing. Ozen is ear. Ozen. Now let me ask you something. In biblical Hebrew and modern Hebrew, a scale. What are the scales? They are balance scales, right? A scale. The word for scale is mosnayim. Mosnayim. Anyone wanna venture a guess at why that's so? Why is Ozen ear and Mosnayim balance?
You need both aspects.
How do you balance? How do you have balance?
The ear.
The whole ear system, the inner ear system. So in Hebrew, the word for ear and the word for balance is the same. Actually, in modern Hebrew, izun is maintaining balance. Right? And ozen is to hear. Because this is creation, and as we said, davar and davar, word and thing. Now, I want to look at some words in English, by the way, and here I could go on forever. There's a whole book called The Word by Isaac Moseson, professor of English at NYU. He wrote a dictionary of rap, of gangster rap, and he also wrote a book called, he's a linguist, right? He's also a religious Jew, so he wrote a book called The Word, showing the origin of Hebrew, the origin of 16 languages in every different language group. Well, but anyway, here's some, which are pretty obvious. Aleph, as the letter, Alpha, right, Aleph, Alpha. Abba, father, abbot, and abbey. Gamal, camel. Bavel, which is the Hebrew word for Babylon. The reason it was called Babylon is because it says Shem Balal, that's where God confused people, Balal. So what is Babel in English? Babel is straight off the Hebrew, right? A behemoth is a beast, which is behemoth, right, in English, right? A cherub, or cherub, kruvim, are cherubs, right, cherub. Yovel is the 50th year of Jubilee. Leviathan, Leviathan in Hebrew is an enormous fish, Leviathan in English, right? Kane is a cane in Hebrew. Kane is a cane. Anyone see a connection there? Canal, channel, same meaning. Right, kinamon is the Hebrew word for cinnamon. In the Bible, it says kinamon, the cinnamon. Right, and nebosem is the Hebrew word for fragrant cane, which the Septuagint translates as cannabis. Kinebosem. Anyone hear the connection there? Kinebosem, fragrant cane, cannabis. Right, it was one of the ingredients in the oil used to put on the utensils in the temple. Not enough to get high, but there was some in there. Now this one, I have a question mark afterwards because I did some research. I'm not so sure if it's correct. But magicians, and this is a very ancient term, always say abracadabra. So Aria Kaplan conjectures that this may be based on an Aramaic term, which is ebara kadabra. I will create as I speak. I'll create as I speak. I say that with conjecture because when I looked into it, I found that there are possible other origins to it from pagan sources. Some say from Christian Gnostic sources, some say from Christian sources, Av, Ben, and Kadosh, which means Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, right, is in the word, so it's not so clear-cut. But in that case, it's a strong possibility, the word Av, Abracadabra, Evara, Kadabra, I will create as I speak, which is a combination, really, of Evara is Hebrew, Kadabra is Aramaic, and it's not really correct Hebrew or Aramaic, so that's why I'm a little skeptical about it. But okay, that's some of the origin. Oh, by the way, English expressions. There's a book by Gabriel Sivan of the Hebrew University called The Impact of the Bible on Civilization. It was unbelievable stuff. How many English expressions come from the Hebrew Bible? Anyway, it's unbelievable, right? For example, escaping from the skinnier teeth. Where's that from? Book of Job. No. Drop in the ocean? Book of Jeremiah. Can a leopard change its spots? Book of Proverbs. Two's better than one? Book of Proverbs. Am I my brother's keeper? Book of Genesis. Right, you can go through the English language, Shakespeare, right, and every work of great literature and all of the English language. And I have a student who did an English literature major. He said his professor told him first day of class, he said, anyone read the Bible? And everyone, of course, no one could read the Bible, right? So he says, I want everyone to read the Bible. And they said, why? He says, every theme in literature, in great literature, there in the Bible. He says, number one. He says, number two, half the expressions in great literature are from the Bible. And he says, number three, most of the language of the English language and the Romance languages, etc., are all from the Bible. He says, so if you know the Bible, he says, that is going to be a key to knowing a tremendous amount. Numbers in Hebrew, very significant. Sheni is two. Two connected to the word shana, which means ear. And yashan, which means sleep. And Yashen, which means sleep, and Yashan, which means... Oh. Anyone see a connection here? I'll tell you why. You see, in Hebrew, our calendar, the Jewish calendar, is a calendar based on the months, on the moon, right? Whereas the calendar of the Egyptians, for example, was based on the sun, the solar calendar. The difference between the solar and the lunar calendar is the following. In the cycles of the sun, the sun's the same all the time. You don't see any cycles in the sun. There's an 11-year solar spot cycle, which you cannot see unless you're a ham radio because it messes up communications every 11 years, right? But basically, right, Shana is the year. It's the year in, same old, year in, interestingly enough, second, sleeping, and old. Whereas in Hebrew, our calendar is based on the Chodesh. Chodesh is a month. What else does the word Chodesh, Chadashim. Chadash. What does chadash mean?
New.
You see, we look at the moon. The moon is a clear cycle. Now you see it. Now you don't. And when you don't see it, but you do see it, and it becomes a full moon, right? So we know it's the reflection of the sun, the moon, etc., etc. But it's a cycle of renewal. It's changing. There's an expression. Nothing new under the sun. You ever heard that expression? Nothing new under the sun. That's from Ecclesiastes, from the Hebrew Bible, right? Nothing new under the sun. Ein chadash tachat hashemesh. Because under the sun, meaning within the natural world, everything is predetermined. However, above the sun, in the supernatural world, in the world of hadash, there is newness, there is free will, ability of creation. And so in our number, and in the Hebrew language, it expresses that. As I said, shalosh, three, shalshelet, to connect a chain. Sheva is seven. It's significant. Sheva also, you can read it as saveya. What does saveya mean? Satiated. What does Shmoneh mean? Eight. One beyond satiation. What's Shemen? Oil, which floats on top. Right? Or Shamenet, fat, which is beyond satiation. Right? It's interesting also that the seven in the Hebrew numbers is the days of creation. Seven is a symbol of nature. The symbol of supernature, going one step beyond nature, is eight. Right, that's why Bris Milah circumcision is on the eighth day. That's why Hanukkah is 8 days. That's why the eighth mitzvah given to humanity after the seven Noahide laws was Bris Milah given to Abraham, because it's one beyond nature. Rest in the Hebrew itself. Right, Amalek. Who was Amalek? Amalek were the. They were the. That's right. They were the worst. They were the combination of Hezbollah, the Nazis, the communists, they're all in one. They were the nastiest people in the Bible. Interestingly enough, they were considered always the ultimate enemies of the Jewish people. Our great sages said the Nazis were Amalek. Now, it's interesting, Amalek has a numerical value of 70 and 40. And 30, well, 70 and 30 is 100, 140, and of course 240, which is the same as the value of Safek. 60 and 80, fake mean? Doubt. What does Amalek represent? Amalek represents a fight against absolute values. In Amalek ideology is, there's only one thing which is right. You know what's right? Might is right. Deutschland über alles, right, which was the German national anthem, from the 1800s onwards, right? That Amalek is Amalek over everything, right? There's no such thing as right and wrong. There's no such thing as that. There's no absolute good. There's no absolute evil. There's no absolute truth, right? Judy has always been a challenge to that, because we represent conscience. We represent the idea that there are absolute truth and absolute morals, absolute values. Ahava we've finished part about the animals, so you don't have to worry about it. Right, so Ahava, as I said, love. Again, numerical value of Echad, which is 13. 13, by the way, we said on Yom Kippur, many more, we kept saying over and over again in synagogue, Hashem, El Rachum Echanan, God, God, who is merciful and graceful, the of mercy. Yes, there are 13 principles of faith. What we said in synagogue was the 13 attributes of divine mercy. Of course, divine mercy is expression of love. It's not by coincidence. There are 13 attributes, oneness of unity. Baal Peh, and Bichtav. Interesting. Baal Peh means oral. Bichtav means written. In Hebrew, right, if you add the numerical value of oral and written, you get the numerical value of Torah. Because you see, our Torah consists of the oral law and the written law. Interestingly enough, the value of the word Torah is 611. The verse says, Torah Sivalanu Moshe. Moses commanded us the Torah. 611. How many commandments are there? 613. So how come it's only 611? The answer is
God added the first two.
That's correct. God told us the first two himself. He said, I am the Lord your God, took you out of Egypt. You shall have no other gods before me. The rest of them were, don't take the name of the Lord your God in vain, right? There's a switch from first person to third person. Who's speaking in the first person? It's God. Right? The rest of the commandments, 611 of them, were given us by Moses. Now, Atbash is a code which the Kabbalists used, which is actually mentioned in the Talmud and the Zohar, in which the first letter of the alphabet, Aleph, is substituted by Taf, and the second letter, Bet, is substituted by Shin, and so on and so forth. So the third letter equals the third last, fourth letter equals fourth last, so on and so forth till you get to the middle. Okay, that's the principle behind that is this verse, Sof Maaseh B'machshavah Techila, the end of action is the first of thought. What does that mean? Think about it. And you have a picture in your mind of what you want to do. What's the first thing, the thought, what's the first thought is the complete building. Complete building, the picture of how it should look. What's the first action? First action for that, yeah, maybe do a drawing, go to the city council, get a license. Something very distant. Very distant from the first thought, isn't it? Your first thought is this beautiful building, etc. Then you have to like step down in your mind till you get to, okay, what's the first action? So really, what's the furthest from each other? The furthest thing is the first thought is quite far from the first action. But the last action equals the first thought. Because the last action is your completed building. And what your first thought was the completed building. What's closest to each other? The last thought and the first action. Because the last thought, your mind's going through the process, okay, I need this building, I need this type of framework, I need this type of foundations, this type of area, this type of land, this type of this. Let's get a permit from the local council for this. Okay? So that's the last thought. So what's the first action? Equals the last thought. The first thought, soft, we say this on Friday night, l'chadodi. Soft ma'aseh, the end of action equals the beginning of thought. So the aleph is the beginning of thought. And the tav is the end of action. So in a sense, aleph, there's one another way of looking at the alphabet is that it's stepping down to each other. The first thought, last action. Second thought equals the second last action. Third thought equals the third last action. Is this clear so far? Now, if you use this method of interpretation, you look at the word mitzvah. What's a mitzvah?
Mem.
A commandment. Mitzvah is mem tzadik, vav and hey. Now, it's interesting. If you look at mem tzadik, Mem is the 10th last letter of the alphabet. So what does it correspond to? Yud. Tzadi is the 5th last letter of the alphabet. What does it correspond to?
Okay.
Hey. Yud hey. So the word mitzvah is mem tzadik, which is yud hey. And the last letters are vav hey, which is, so it's God's name. However, I cheated, right? Because vav hey is without being decoded. Mem tzadik, you have to decode it, correct? The answer is, the life in this world, God is revealed and concealed. There's a revelation of God and there's concealment. We had revelations of God when he gave us the Torah, when he took us out of Babylon, when many times in history God revealed himself. But he's not always revealed, he's concealed. God's revealed and concealed. So when we do a mitzvah, that's a method of revealing the name of God in the world, decoding the name of God, going from the first thought to the last action. That's what the mitzvah is. So therefore, it's fitting that the word mitzvah has God's name revealed at the end and concealed at the beginning. For mitzvah, we're really decoding the world and turning it into Yud Kei and Vav Kei, God's holy name, Yud and Hey and Vav and Hey. Jewish philosophy, we find a lot of ideas. For instance, Emet. Interesting, the word Emet, which means truth, is the first letter of the alphabet, the last letter of the alphabet, and the middle letter of the alphabet. That's not by coincidence. It really literally is. Aleph, first letter. Taf, last letter. Mem is the middle. And so Rashi tells us, because truth is the name of God. Was, he is. Now, also, truth requires more effort to find. You see, sheker means lies or falsehood. Where are the letters of sheker found in the alphabet? All together. They're all together at the end of the alphabet. What that tells us is it's easy to find falsehood. However, it's all the letters are right next to each other at the end of the alphabet. Emet, you have to look at the beginning, the middle, and the end. You have to put effort to find truth. Truth requires effort. Falsehood, no effort. This is very much like the law of entropy. Okay? No effort, disorder. No effort, falsehood. Effort, order. Effort, there is truth. Also, Emet is totally balanced. There's one extreme, there's the other extreme, and there's the middle. It's a balanced thing. Sheker is all the way at the end. Interestingly enough, when they used to teach this to children in Talmudic times, they'd also point out to them, look at the base upon which Emet stands, truth stands, and look at the base upon which Sheker stands. Okay? Which is more stable? Emet. Sheker is all top-heavy here, you know what I mean? The center of gravity is up there, and it's standing on a little point of the kuf. Right? And by the way, the letters of Emet are in order, aren't they? Aleph, Mem, Tav. The letters of Sheker are actually out of order. Because in the alphabet it's really Kuf, Resh, Shin. Kuf, Resh, Shin. So we learn a lot just from the alphabet and the structure. Gemilut Chesed. Gemilut Chesed, as I said, is bestowing kindness. But remember I also said Gomel is to wean. Because the ultimate kindness is one you can wean someone from. Baruch, we say God is blessed. Baruch means blessed. It's Hebrew. The word Berecha in biblical Hebrew is a... What's a Berecha? A pool. Berecha. It actually is the pool when a spring. As modern Hebrew, it's a Berecha Sechia, is a swimming pool. But in biblical Hebrew, Berecha refers to the pool from which the spring bubbles out of the ground, and there's a pool there. When we say, God, you are Baruch, blessed, what we actually mean is, you are the spring from which everything comes. It's a description of God as Baruch. You are the source of everything. You are like the spring from which bubbles absolutely everything we have. A spring which is continuously, what is called Ma'ayan Hamit Barech, a spring that is blessed, meaning a spring that is continuously giving forth. Right? So it's Baruch is actually the pool from which everything springs. I didn't put it by the way, Mayim, the Hebrew word for water, this is actually interesting. I don't have it here. Water, it's Mem, Yud Mem. Remind you of anything? Yud Mem. Mem, Yud Mem. Everyone think of the molecular structure of water? What, how would it look? You'd have O, H, H, O, right? H, H. Mayim, it actually looks almost exactly the same. It's like Mem, Mem, Yud. Okay, I don't know if there's any significance, but it does. An idea and its opposite. In Hebrew, what you find is that certain words mean the exact opposite of each other. Ra means evil. Rea means friend. Kar means essence. Oker means uproot. Shoresh means root. Lahashrish means to dig up from the very roots. Er means a descendant. Ariri means to die without a descendant. Azav means to abandon. Ozev means to help. Shachar means morning. Shachor means dark. Means black. Ozev. Azov ta'azov imo, the Torah says. Help him. Al ta'azveni. Don't abandon me. So Ozev means abandon. Ozev means to help. Right? Arm. Er means Elah. Er ve'onav Yisrael. A descendant. Ariri means to die without a descendant. Right, so what's the meaning of this? So the Maharal tells us, he says, it's teaching us monotheism. Why? Because in monotheism, we believe, we know one. We say this in our prayers, Yotzer Or Uvarer Ra. God, he creates good and evil. Right? Oseh Shalom, right? Everything comes from God. We say in our prayers, Yotzer Or Uvarer Choshech. Right? Darkness. But the original verse is Ra. But in any case, we say that everything comes from one source. Hebrew teaches us monotheism as well. This is, again, the scroll of Isaiah. Right, from the Dead Sea Scrolls, and it's written in the same Hebrew. Today, any of us, if we knew Hebrew, we could schmooze with Isaiah. Isaiah the prophet, we could have the same, right, if we know the Hebrew language, then we know the essence of the Torah and of creation, and if we know the Torah, then we can look into the essence of the Hebrew language. When we know the Hebrew language, we have a connection to Jews for thousands of years, and Jews all over the world, and it's an amazing and beautiful idea. That's a little bit of an introduction. It's not the end. It's an introduction to the Hebrew language. And with that, we're going to end. And thank you very much for coming.